This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lefebvre, your guest host tonight on the People Speak Radio, filling in for Bessemer Farhat. At the People Speak, we believe that the voices and actions of ordinary people make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak at bbsradio.com, live every Tuesday night from 8:55 to 9:55 Eastern Time. You can also log in to our website at peoplespeakradio.com to listen to us live, join us through our live chat on Paltalk, or listen to the archives of previous shows. We broadcast 1 hour live to the USA, UK, Canada, and Australia. If you have questions for our guests, you can call 415-762-1160 or 712-432-0075, access 318-116. We take calls during the second half of the show. You can also listen and call via your smartphone so you never have to miss the best guest on internet radio. Tonight, our guest is Irving Rosenfeld, the second of four surviving medical marijuana patients who received their medicine from the U.S. federal government that we have talked to on the show. Irving won the right to use the medicine that brought him relief in 1982, and has been active in the battle since then to expand that right to every citizen of this country. He recently published his book, My Medicine, How I Convinced the U.S. Government to Provide My Marijuana and Helped Launch a National Movement. Good evening, Irv. We are so happy to have you with us tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good evening to you, too.
Now, as I stated, we spoke with George McMahon back in August, and he also suggested we talk to you. And since we did cover a great deal of information with him, I really would like to focus on your book tonight. I understand it largely deals with your experience in fighting with the federal government for the right to use your medicine.
Oh, that's a good part of it. Yes, actually, it's a basic autobiography as far as dealing with my bone disorder. Discovering at age 10 this severe bone tumor disorder that I had, that I was told potentially I might not outlive my teenage years. The story of the surgeries, what I went through in teenage years and surviving, the different medicines I took, the different drugs, from morphine to you name it, being an advocate against marijuana in high school in late 60s, early 70s. Why would a healthy person use illegal drugs when here I wasn't healthy and I had to use regular drugs? And then discovering quite by accident in college the medical benefits, and then the 10-year struggle of taking on the federal government, trying to educate them, and finally winning. And then the rest of it is basically the history of the medical cannabis movement in this country, as seen through my eyes, plus all the trials and tribulations of being a federal patient and the obstacles you run across even being a federal patient. Another underlying aspect of the book is really teaching parents how to deal with a child who has a devastating disorder, because I just don't believe that it's done correctly in this country today. And that's something I wanted to address also in the book. So that's basically, it wraps up book up in a nutshell.
Now, are you willing to tell us a little bit about your disorder? I've read up a little bit on it, but I can't explain it to the audience.
Now, of course, the medical names, I have two of them. The first disorder was diagnosed at age 10. It's called multiple congenital cartilaginous exostosis. What that means is at puberty, whatever tumors I had, and what it means is bone tumors on the ends of most long bones of the body. And whatever tumors I had at puberty would grow as I grow. Hopefully, I would develop no new ones. Now, these would grow, and the ones that grew too quickly, I had to have taken out, or they'd have gone malignant. The ones that grew towards the growth centers of the body had to be taken out because it would have stunted growth. And then ones that just caused, you know, pure pain that were in a bad area had to be taken out. But yet, I had over 200 of these tumors in my body, so they couldn't take them all out. So the parameters that were set and that I lived by and, you know, had surgeries by. Then at age 19, after my growth centers were all closed, I started developing new tumors, which shouldn't have happened. And it wasn't until 3 years, 2 years later, that they discovered I had a second disorder called a variant of the syndrome pseudo-pseudo-hypoparathyroidism, which means I can now develop new tumors at any age and existing ones can grow at any time. I had several new tumors grow between 19 and age 21, and luckily I've not had a tumor grow or new one develop since age 21, which was 36 years ago. And the doctors don't know why. I attribute that to the medical cannabis. It's kept the tumors from growing. So the cannabis has served me as a muscle relaxant. It serves, relaxes the muscles and the veins going over these tumors that stick up into them, thereby easing the muscle tension, easing the muscle pain, and also making it less likely that I tear a muscle or tear a vein and hemorrhage and a clot can break off and kill me. There's also a sac of fluid over each tumor called a bursa. It's trying to protect the muscle and the vein from the tumor so it doesn't tear. The more that's inflamed, the higher chance of malignancy it has. And then my right ankle, the tibia and the fibia is fused by a huge tumor. And there it's painful, you know, all the time. So there it serves as analgesic and actually breaks up the pain. It diffuses it, makes it less intense. So that's basically what cannabis does for me.
Now, prior to using medical cannabis, what medications were you taking for pain?
The main medications I started with as a teenager, I mean, 13, was Demerol was the main pain medication I was taking. I was taking Paraffin Forte, Butazol, which is a muscle relaxant. I was taking Butazolidin Alka, which was a anti-inflammatory drug. And I really wasn't taking much for sleeping. I was mostly, for sleeping, I was using alcohol at night at that point. And that would, which would make you tired and take some pain away, and that would help. Then, as I turned 18, then I started using synthetic morphine, which was Dilaudid, 4 milligram. I was using methaqualone, which was Soper, 300 milligram, for sleeping. And also, if you took a half of one, it helped for some reason for the pain. Again, taking other muscle relaxants, other sleeping medications, and other anti-inflammatory drugs, all in different combinations and quite extensively, quite a bit.
Do you know how many drugs you might have been taking at any one time, looking back now?
Yeah, probably no more than 8 different types.
Now, in looking back at the time when you were taking the pharmaceutical drugs, did they impair your functioning? Did they make it difficult for you to get through daily life, or did it give you a reasonable level of function?
Well, in my opinion, it gave me a reasonable level of function. Some other people at times thought that wasn't the case. But it did make you lethargic, okay, and you were dependent on it. Plus, after I started taking the Dilaudid, I limited myself in what I did because it would be real easy for me to hurt myself and not realize it because of the masking of the pain. So I gave up all sports. I had to be very careful. I ran a furniture business. So I had to be very careful in my movements and in lifting or moving any furniture. Because, again, you just didn't feel as much because of the Dilaudid. So, and again, it upset your eating habits, upset your sexual habits and by taking those drugs. I mean, it definitely impaired your life that cannabis doesn't do any of that, you know, today. So, I mean, I haven't taken any of those pills since 1990.
And that's part of where I was leading to, because I'm also a medical cannabis patient, one of the more recent ones. My state only legalized in 2008. And one of the standing arguments is that chronic use of marijuana makes you stupid. It impairs your function. It makes you lazy. But I understand that your life has taken definitely not stupid, lazy, or non-functional turns since you started medicating with cannabis. You want to tell the audience a little bit about what you do that you can do now that you couldn't do before?
What can I do now that I couldn't do before? Well, first of all, I'm still able to do mostly whatever I did before, and just enhance it, makes it better and easier to do it today. Okay, sports-wise, again, I can do a lot more sports. I play softball every Sunday, even though I cannot run the bases anymore. I hit the ball, somebody stands behind the catcher, and they run. I can still play defense. I teach disabled, mentally and physically challenged children and adults. I teach them how to sail with an adaptive sailboat program in Miami called Shake a Leg. And we have sailboats with chairs built into the boat to where we actually can strap in a paraplegic, quadriplegic, whatever disability, And with a tiller extender, with an extender that's hooked to the rudder, they can actually sit in the chair and sail the boat and leave the wheelchair on the dock. And so it gives them independence. And so I'm able to do that. And again, if I didn't have the medicine, I wouldn't be able to do any of that, because most likely I would be homebound. If I was still alive, I would not be out in society. Now, for a living, I'm a stockbroker. I've been a stockbroker now for 24 years. I've been on the medication for 28 years. So being on cannabis for 28 years, or 4 years at the time under the federal government when I took the exam, definitely proves that I wasn't stupid. I was able to learn a business and pass a test that at the time I studied a little less than a month. There were 12 people from my firm, some with MBAs, a couple CPAs, and they all failed. I passed the test the first time. So it just definitely, at that point, I hadn't really taken the test. I hadn't been in school since age 19. I had not studied anything since age 19. And here they tell me, here's a test that I've got to take, a six-hour test, that nationwide 10 to 12% pass, and that's it. And the firm informed me that most likely I would fail the first time, and I either passed the second time or I've been fired. Well, I passed the first time. So the idea that medical cannabis inhibits you in any way is just not true. Okay, and I'm living proof of that. And when they say that possibly there might be potential lung damage, well, Dr. Donald Tashkin, who was the main physician for the federal government for the last 30 to 40 years, has done research to try to prove the detriments of medical cannabis to the human body. Now, I've always respected Dr. Tashkin because he's had a premise, he's done his study, and then he's reported his results. Well, his last study he did before he left the federal government was a 10-year study to prove once and for all that lung cancer was caused by cannabis, by marijuana. And this 10-year study he did, he could not find one case. At the end, he reported, he could not find one case of lung cancer due to cannabis. However, he also stated that for some reason, the people that used cigarettes and medical cannabis had less cancers than people who just used cigarettes, but he wasn't sure why. So I think that kind of puts to sleep the idea that it causes any type of lung damage. In fact, I think it's a neuroprotectant. I think that that's the reason that cigarette smokers don't get the cancers, because cannabis is a neuroprotectant, I think, in that respect. I mean, they're learning now different cannabinoids that are working to delineate tumors and studies in rats. They've delineated tumors in brains. I mean, so I think that they're, you know, down the road, they're going to find that, again, yeah, cannabis is the miracle drug that's been on this earth forever. And we're just now learning all the useful functions of it.
Now, is our federal government funding studies for the benefits of marijuana as medicine?
Our federal government isn't, to my knowledge, isn't funding anybody to do research on medical marijuana. Okay, there are private companies that are looking at synthetic cannabinoids taking out of the cannabis and then maybe using it. There's GW Pharmaceuticals out of England that is working with the natural plant and turning it into a sublingual spray. It's now legal in Canada. It's legal in England, Spain, New Zealand, and they can use it for mostly for neuropathic pain for multiple sclerosis, and in Canada for pain due to cancer. In this country, they are doing research on phase 3 studies with human patients, and what it's for is an adjunct medicine for opiates. So if you're a cancer patient and you're using opiates and they give you Sativex and it enhances the effects of your opiates, well, then it's working. And the reason the federal government originally gave it to me in 1982 was my doctor and I had done a study with Dilaudid that showed that when I had cannabis to go with it, it enhanced the effects of the Dilaudid, and I took less. When I didn't have enough cannabis or none at all, well, then my use of Dilaudid was increased substantially. So I know that Sativex will be approved. And the interesting aspect is the federal government wants to see Sativex approved, because they think that's going to stop smoking marijuana. And we don't need to smoke marijuana because we'll have Sativex. Of course, the way I look at it is just the exact opposite. Number one, it's going to be expensive, and not everybody's going to have insurance. Number two, a lot of people that are on medical disability and are using medical cannabis barely make any money. I mean, they get disability payments, and they're not going to have enough money to buy Sativex. And also, right now, the federal government says that the natural plant cannabis is Schedule 1, has no medical value. But when they finally approve Sativex for GW, well, well, that's going to be the natural plant, but in a sublingual sprite. So I feel like it's going to be very difficult for the government to say, well, you know, the plant, natural plant in a sublingual sprite is a medicine, but cannabis is not the natural plant. So I think I'll have a better leg to stand on by saying, well, they're both a natural plant. One's just in the spray form, and one's in a smoking form. And so I look forward to the day that Sativex is finally approved in this country. But then, no, the government, to my knowledge, is not paying for any research, especially when it comes to the smoked form of cannabis.
So then the legalization, the approval of this would just be a way to extend your fight, which brings me to another question, and I generally ask this of all guests. You know, you were approved to use medical cannabis back in 1982, and from your own statement, you've experienced a tremendous amount of relief from it. You were able to get on and do amazing things in your personal life, in your business, in your volunteer work. Why would you go ahead and continue to fight to expand the right to others? There's a lot of people who I've got mine, and I'm good, and I can use it until I die now, so why worry?
Well, that's pretty simple, actually. A lot of people helped me to get to where I was, to where I was able to challenge the federal government and win. And when you have a devastating disorder, it sucks. But if you can make something good come out of something bad, it makes you feel better. So what I'm trying to do is take my severe bone disorder, which sucks, and because of what I've accomplished, now try to help others. So what I see, all these other states pass laws and all these other patients that are able to get the relief that they need, while they may not be a federal patient, at least now they're not a criminal in their own state. And it makes me feel really good. Because when I think back, and back in the 70s, when it was Bob Randall who was the first patient and myself, and we were the only two people, to my knowledge back then, I almost felt like we were the only two people in the country that even knew the benefits of medical cannabis. So to be able to watch this whole process evolve, I've been very proud of what we've accomplished, but we haven't finished it. We haven't done it yet because there's only 14 states in the District of Columbia, and even in those 14 states now, I mean, with the right-wing religious aspect that we're going towards after this last election, there are actually people in certain states that have laws now that they want to repeal the law and then take away the right for the patients to even use in those states that have already passed it. So I don't want to see any steps go backwards. I want to move forward. But what that's going to mean until we actually win is until every patient has the right to use it, where a doctor has the right to recommend or prescribe, the right to, you know, either call it a medicine, call it a nutraceutical, call it, you know, a plant. I don't care what you call it. I mean, if it doesn't fit under the auspices of what FDA considers medicine, well, then they need to come up with another category. Because FDA almost makes it sound like that before FDA was around and could sanction medicine, we had no medicine in this country or anywhere else in the world because FDA didn't sanction it. And that's just not true. Okay, I mean, they say anecdotal doesn't work. Anecdotal, when you have hundreds and hundreds of thousands, anecdotal means something. And it's the simple fact that the federal government's been giving me this cannabis for 28 years. Now, they've never bothered to study me or any of the other patients. We had to do that on our own. We had to do a private study. But the point is, for 28 years they've been giving me this. If anything was detrimental, anything bad would have happened from using it, I think it would have shown up already. And it hasn't.
Okay, and you mentioned the fact that in 28 years it hasn't done you any harm and that the government has never checked that you did your own study, which brings me to the other thing I really wanted to touch on tonight, is the Missoula study.
Yeah.
We touched on it briefly with George, but that's been a few weeks, so if you would mind filling us in on what it was and what it was intended to establish and what it did establish.
Right. Well, since the federal government had never studied any of us patients, we wanted to have some type of baseline to see, number one, if we had any problems because of it. Because, again, you want to believe, even though we didn't really believe that it harmed any of us, we thought, well, you know, it might have done some kind of damage, but the good far outweighs the bad. And so myself, George, and Elvi flew to Missoula, Montana, and there Dr. Ethan Russo, neurologist, did a complete battery of tests on us to try to show if any detriment or any harm had been caused by medical cannabis. They did brainwave testing, they did IQ testing, respiratory, memorization, MRI of the brain. I mean, they did everything they could think of. And they did the same thing for Barbara Douglas, but they went to her house in Iowa and did everything at her house because she's too sick to leave. And they did all this testing, and at the end, all the results showed that all four of us were perfectly normal, that medical cannabis had not harmed any of us. And in fact, because of cannabis, we've all been able to lead a much better and better quality life, that we're not on all the different drugs that we used to take, especially George and I. I mean, because, again, we're pain, muscle tension, spasticity, him, breakage bones, and organ problems. I mean, he's you know, much sicker than even I am. I mean, I just have a pain disorder. And so we've been able to live a much better quality life because of the medical cannabis and not harmed at all. And so it used to be, before we did the study, when people would say how detrimental it was, like, for your lungs. And I would say, well, it hasn't harmed me. They'd say, well, you're the 85-year-old man who smokes 2.5 packs of cigarettes a day and says, what do you mean it causes lung cancer? Never bothered me. So I was the anomaly. Well, now after we did the study and all four of us were perfectly normal, well, now I wonder if our opposition says, well, gee, all four of you are the anomalies, but anybody else in the country, if they used it, would be harmed by it, which, of course, I know that's just not true.
Now that we have 14 states that have legalized for medical, so now we have an increasing number of patients who can safely say, yes, I've been smoking every day for X number of years, however long it's been legal in their state, where they could expand that study. Do you know of anybody who is looking at doing a broader study? Or, and obviously, I'm already aware that the federal government is not in the least bit interested in funding anything that's looking for a positive benefit for marijuana.
No, they're not funding anything. There is no studies going on. But really, when you say that a person can report that, let's say like a California patient, let's use that. So they've had it since 96. So it's been 14 years. A person can say that they've been using it for 14 years. But how much? What strengths? I mean, they can't document it. So really, you wouldn't be able to use a state patient in reality. I mean, you can anecdotally, you can listen to them and you could study them if you wanted to, but you really don't have, you know, you really don't have the baseline or the knowledge that we have, because we know exactly how many cigarettes we've gotten over the years. We know the strength of them. So that makes it much easier to, you know, when you do a study to say, well, this patient has received X number of cigarettes. And then myself, in the 28 years, I've received over 120,000 medical cannabis cigarettes, documented. We know that for a fact. And that doesn't count the 11 years before when I was illegal that I was using it.
Okay, so and that, in fact, means that you currently hold the record of the established amount of marijuana cigarettes smoked. But it was announced in Normal that you had, in fact, won the record in the Book of Guinness. Well, the Guinness Book of World Records.
No,
and when I mentioned that to you, you told me that wasn't quite correct, and why. Would you mind telling the audience why they will not include you in the Guinness Book?
Right. They will not include this record in the Guinness Book because what they stated was that for a record to be sanctioned, it has to be something that can be beaten. And because no one can document that how much cannabis they've smoked, except for the four of us federal patients, and I have a 6-year lead on Elvy, okay? So therefore, in their opinion, it can never be beaten. So therefore, they will not sanction it. So what I can state publicly is I applied, and they turned me down for that reason. Now, if I die at some point, well, an Elvy outlives me by another 6 years, well, then Elvy could call them up and say, hey, wait a minute, I beat his record. You know, he's dead. He's been gone 6 or 7 years. I'm still alive. I'm still getting it now. I've gotten it longer than he has. So now we sanction me because I beat him. Who knows? And then maybe they'll say, well, but nobody could beat you. Hopefully George is still alive. Hopefully Barbara's still alive at that point. And hopefully I am too. I don't want them to let them catch me or beat me on that.
Oh, no, I've told George any number of times, I want you and him both to live a very long time and be a thorn in the side of the federal government for any reason.
No, that's very true. And George does a lot of good work from his place in Iowa. He really does. George has done tremendous work. And I hope he continues to, because I'll tell you something. It's been tiring for us patients because we're so, in so many ways, we're so tired of doing this. I mean, we want to win already. And it's been so much easier knowing that I can rely on George to help, that it's important, and I can rely on LV. And like I said, Barbara now is a little tougher. She doesn't help out as much because she's just not well. That's really her problem.
Now, in the years that you've been involved in this fight, now, obviously, when you first became a patient, there were very few federal patients. No states have gone legal. 14 states have legalized, at least at the state level, though we don't have the level of protection that you and George do. What other changes have you seen in the attitudes and organizations that have gotten behind medical cannabis over the years?
Well, originally, way back then, when it was just Bob and I, and the LV didn't come until 88, we actually had 34 states that did pass medical marijuana laws in the late 70s and early 80s. But it didn't mean that any of the patients got their medicine, because they didn't. And now the changes have been dramatic. I mean, because we have got 14 states that have passed laws. We do have organizations like Patients Out of Time that's evolved from other organizations such as Normal that have evolved now to be able to really expose the science and have it accepted. I mean, our conferences that we put on every 2 years, we bring in the top scientists, doctors, nurses, patients from around the world, and to talk about what they've researched and what they've done with different cannabinoids or aspects of cannabis. And the AMA sanctions our conference and says that doctors will get continuing education credits to go to our conference and learn about medical cannabis. Because, again, doctors aren't taught this in school. They don't know this. Yet the AMA, the American Medical Association, sanctions our conference to do that. Now, the American Nurses Association, highest organization for nurses in this country, sanctions our conference to send nurses to go, and if they attend our conference, they get continuing education credit. So the ANA is telling their nurses, go to their conference, learn about medical cannabis, and we're going to give you continuing education credits for it. So that's remarkable when you think about it. And not only that, thank God with technology the way it is, if you can't attend our conference, even today, you can go to our website, medicalcannabis.com. If you're a doctor, if you're a nurse, or you're a health practitioner that has to do continuing education credits, you can go to our website, you can pay a fee, nominal fee, download our conference, and still learn about it and still get your continuing education credits. You can even go to the University of California, San Francisco, their website, and do the same thing. So the fact that, you know, the government can say that it has no medical value. Okay, the federal government says it has no medical value. Okay, so they say that. But yet, you know, 8 weeks ago, the VA, government agency, Veterans Administration, the doctor just came out saying it is medical marijuana. It is a medicine. And in fact, in those 14 states now, if you're a veteran and you test positive for metabolites of cannabis, it used to be they would withhold your opiates if you're on opiates. So if you're a Rocky veteran who's lost a leg or something like that, and you're in California or any of the other 13 states, and now the VA's been told that medical marijuana is a medicine, so therefore if they test positive, give them their opiates. But yet, in the other states that don't have it, what are veterans going to do? In our country, you can't discriminate against veterans. A veteran that got his leg shot off in Iraq and California should be afforded the same rights as a veteran that got their leg shot off in Florida. You know, if they're living in Florida, it should be the same thing. And so that's still, you know, yet to be argued. But the point is, the federal government has said that it's a medicine. Okay? All these states are saying, you know, it is a medicine. So the federal government can say whatever they want, that it may not be. But the fact that the AMA sanctions our conference for doctors to learn about it, why would the AMA sanction our conference for doctors to learn about something that's not a medicine? Why would the ANA sanction our conference, American Nurses Association, sanction our conference for nurses to take the time to learn about medical cannabis if it's not a medicine? So the fact that the government, part of the government, is saying that it's not a medicine, I think that they're learning it's a losing battle. And eventually that is going to be overturned. Eventually we are going to win. Eventually we will have the right for doctors, medicine will be in the hands of physicians, and doctors will have the right to make a medical decision, not a law enforcement official that has no medical degree.
Now, we're going to go into the realm of opinion here, because over the years, now, frankly, I've been legal for a little over a year. I'm not going to deny that. I knew that cannabis was effective to control my seizures long before that. And I've always felt that the government is rather cynical, that there is no way that they cannot know that this is medicine, yet they still keep it illegal. What would be your opinion as to why they would do this?
Oh, it's the money. That's why they keep it illegal. 80 to 90% of the U.S. population is in favor of medical cannabis. So if 80% or 90%, wouldn't you think politicians would jump on that bandwagon and say, oh, man, my constituents want this, let's do it? But they haven't. Well, gee, I wonder why. I'll tell you why. The money. Okay, the lobbying money. The big pharmaceutical industry, the lobby for that is huge, okay? And it's like when I testified in Congress that as a stockbroker, if medical marijuana became available tomorrow, I'd be calling all my clients up and saying, sell your drug stocks, because people wouldn't be buying their drugs as much if medical cannabis was available. So that's a big lobby organization. So they funnel a lot of money to politicians to make sure politicians don't vote this in. Now, if medical cannabis became available tomorrow, the hemp product would be next. Now, hemp now can be used for all kinds of different things, of course. I'm not an expert when it comes to the hemp is like I am when it comes to medical cannabis. But hemp could be used for, let's say, something simple like paper. You could grow it and make paper. Well, the lumber industry sure doesn't want to see that happen, because that would harm all their trees that they take 30 and 40 years to grow. So they're against medical cannabis because they can't afford hemp. They don't want to see hemp happen. Okay, it's clothing. You can make clothing out of it. Well, the petrochemical companies that make nylon and rayon, well, they don't want to see that happen because that would hurt their bottom line. So therefore, they're against medical cannabis because hemp could be next. Then you have the cotton industry, big industry in this country. Okay? Well, the cotton industry wants to protect their own, so therefore, they're against it. And now the laws themselves. Well, why would we want to change the laws themselves? If we change the laws, the taxpayers would save money, the cities would save money. But who would lose money by changing laws? Well, if we change the laws, the biggest losers would be the prisons and the people that make money prosecuting and the people that provide the food for the prisons. All those people's bottom line would be hurt. So therefore, they don't want to see that happen. So they want the status quo, and they want to keep it the same, so they're against medical cannabis. So you have all these major lobby organizations working against the patient. And what does the patient have? All the patient has is their suffering that they're trying to tell people about, but then the federal government says, well, that's anecdotal. That's anecdotal. And so a scientist or a person who has studied, especially take a DEA agent who supposedly has studied cannabis, they've studied it and they understand it and they know it and they say how bad it is and they're against it. Isn't that amazing? Somebody who's never used it at all, be it supposedly they consider themselves a so-called expert, they go against a patient who uses it because it's anecdotal. What do you mean it helps with your pain? Yeah, right. What do you mean it helps with your seizures? Yeah, right. You know? No, it doesn't. Because I'm the expert. I'm the DEA guy. I'm the one who studied this. I'm the one who made a Schedule 1 and says it's no medicine, so therefore it's not. So, you know, I don't care about your anecdotal thing says, because science, FDA says if it was a medicine, it would be able to go through FDA studies. And you can't do that. So therefore it's not a medicine. You know, in my book, one time I did a documentary that actually won an Emmy, regional Emmy for PBS, and I gave them a cartoon. And that was in the Wall Street Journal. And they showed it. And the cartoon was two gentlemen sitting at a desk, each at one desk, and looking at each other. And behind them was a sign that said FDA. And one said to the other, hey, if laughter is the best medicine, shouldn't we be regulating it? Think about that.
And if the government could, you know they would.
Exactly. That's
And because that takes us into, because talking about the various other uses of hemp, you know, many of us are aware that the either the Declaration of Independence, I believe the Declaration of Independence was written on hemp paper.
Exactly.
That our forefathers advocated the growing of hemp, and that recently California was had a proposition to legalize hemp for recreational use, and one of the arguments was with the economy so bad, this is an avenue of revenue for the states that we can't afford to ignore or keep criminal at this point in time. How would you see that particular argument? Because Michigan is also contemplating a hemp farming bill.
Right. When you said hemp for recreational use, it would be hemp for farming is what you're talking about.
Yeah, hemp for farming. But in California,
right,
you said hemp
for recreation. Okay, so hemp for farming, let's put it this way. When I testified in Montana, when I talked to Montana about 2 months ago, when I got off the plane, I saw all this land. Okay, I saw all this vacant land. And we have farmers that, you know, are out of work and, you know, and this, that, and the other. But yet, isn't it great in this country? We can import. We can import. And this is what I kept saying. The government allows us to import all the hemp products we want from other countries. But yet, we have all this land. We can't grow it here because the federal government says we can't. Screw the federal government. Like I told them, why are you letting the people in Washington tell you what to do? Washington says that medical marijuana or cannabis has no medical value. But you went against them for that, didn't you? You said it does, and we're going to take away the crime from our patients and allow our patients to stop suffering needlessly. So you went against the feds for that. Why don't you go against the feds for hemp? I said, it's ridiculous. When you mentioned this country, okay, I'm from Virginia. When Virginia, which is the beginning of our country, you weren't allowed to have property in Virginia, the new land, new country, unless you grew a certain amount of hemp. That was law. You had to. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, they all grew hemp. Okay, they all grew it because that was the major product back then. And so did they smoke it or whatever? I'm sure that they probably, you know, did learn something like that. But it was a major revenue source. Again, the flags, the ropes, paper, even in World War II, hemp for victory. Even though it was illegal up to, you know, been illegal since 1937, once the war started, they allowed you to grow it again because they needed it for hemp, for rope production. And but yet after the war, they said, no, we didn't use it. But yet there was that movie, Hemp for Victory, so they really did. So I think the states need to go against the federal government in that aspect, California, any of the states, and decide, well, you know, if we can import hemp, damn it, we can grow it here. Let's put our people to work. Let's give our people jobs. Why send them overseas? Okay, and but yet it's the same basic rhetoric that the federal government's allowing us to do. Is to say, hey, this is what we say it is, whether it's logical or not. Cannabis has no medical value, and hemp, you can't grow it. But you can import it, you can sell it, and they're not stopping the states from medical use for the 14 states now, but yet they did say they would come down on California for, you know, legalization. But they didn't say they'd, you know, clamp down on the medical, just on the total legalization. So I feel like that, you know, eventually that in our country, these people will get smart enough economically. I mean, the worse our country gets economically, hopefully it will be one day where, you know, hemp production is allowed. It will be one day where there's no longer a crime for having medical cannabis. There's got to be a better way than arresting somebody, wasting taxpayers' money, prosecuting somebody, and then possibly even putting them in jail. When you put somebody in jail, it costs taxpayers money. And there's a good chance that now that taxpayer that's now in jail, their family now is probably going on welfare because he's not earning a living or she's not earning a living. And now they're on welfare, that's costing us tax money, that's costing us even more. So it's just, we can't afford morality anymore. Okay, who's to say what's moral or not? Let's be logical, and let's, you know, put people to work and be logical about this.
Okay, Irving, I'm going to break in here now. I'm starting to get some questions in from listeners. I'm getting these through text, so I'll read them to you. From Dave in Rhode Island. I understand that federal marijuana is very mediocre quality. Have you used superior strains, and have they provided better results for your condition?
Okay, the government cannabis is adequate. It works. Now, when people seem to think that the higher strength of THC equates to better medicine, that's not necessarily true. We've come to believe that for muscle relaxant, anti-inflammatory, for pain, CBD, not THC, works better for us. Well, CBD is non-psychoactive. It's an antagonist, in fact, to THC. So therefore, the fact that the THC level may not be as high as some other cannabises that they talk about doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't work. Now, I will not run out of my medicine. So there are times that I have the government has been delayed on shipments, and I've had to go to get others. And it's, you know, I don't get high off any cannabis. I never have. My body just doesn't do it. So would other cannabis have different results? Well, I'm sure it would be, because every different cannabis has different cannabinoids in them and different strains. So everyone would be very different. But just because one's high in THC doesn't necessarily mean that it would help. In fact, the government came out with one time a higher THC of, it was 5.99. Ours that we've been getting now is about 3.60. And so LV calls me up and says, "Irvin, they've got 5.99, just came out with it, and you know, and I'm using it, and it, you know, I can't tell any difference from my glaucoma, but my little bit of arthritis seems to be a little better. Maybe you should try it." Well, my doctor didn't want me to try it. Thought it was thought it would fry my brain, as he put it. And my doctor is not the most knowledgeable when it comes to the subject, but at least he takes care of me. So I called George, and George says, "Well, my doctor will order it. You know, let me try it." So George orders it, and about 2 weeks later, he calls me up after he gets it, and he was furious. And I'm going, "What's wrong?" He said, "Irvin, you don't know how bad off I am." I go, "What's wrong, George?" He said, "We got this new medicine in, and it's higher THC, and I'm doing worse with this." So right there showed us that just because it's higher THC, it doesn't mean that for certain conditions it's better cannabis.
And that's one of the reasons they need to do more serious research to define which active ingredients are most effective on which conditions.
Exactly.
I have another question for you. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's all I'm going to say is that I wish the government would, and I'm glad to see now that the individual states, a lot of the different areas, the compassion centers are keeping records and trying to compare records with each other. Plus, Fred Gardner's O'Shaughnessy's, which is a newspaper that's put out by the doctors in California, and I think maybe Oregon and Washington, they're trying to keep those records to find out, let's say, like, again, if you have seizures, that if there's one strain that people seem to like that have seizures, that they would be able to let, you know, other patients know that. So it's important that this is done.
Now, from Mike in California, has any Congress member agreed to work with you and doctors in presenting to Congress the idea that marijuana is a valid approach to medical problems, or are all the politicians owned by the pharmaceuticals?
In 1994, maybe a little less than that, my Congressman Harry Johnston, here in Florida, was very receptive, did whatever he could to try to educate and people on medical cannabis. And he wrote letters to different organizations, to DEA, to FDA, did whatever he could, and got nowhere. Then Robert Wexler took over, and he said he was going to do everything that Harry Johnson did. And so when he got elected and I asked him to support me, it took him a year before he came on board. And again, it took him not much long to learn about it. But he did, and then he became my biggest supporter. Well, he just retired, and we now have a new congressman. And so I'm hoping to be able to bring him on board, but it hasn't happened yet. So right now I don't have a congressman. I'm hoping, though, that at some point to be able to approach certain congressmen from certain areas that we do know are receptive. And hopefully with my book in hand, I mean, my book's a great lobbying tool. I mean, that's what's really, you know, so important about the book, that not only will people learn the history of it, but they'll, you know it and sound more knowledgeable when they talk to somebody who's important, when they're trying to get their impression made as far as a vote. But then they'll be able to take that book, and even if the main person doesn't read it, somebody on the staff will have to read it, and they'll realize that it's real and it's true. So that's what we hope to accomplish.
Well, I know we've encountered that in Michigan. We've been legal a very short time, but patients have already contacted our senators and congresspeople with letters. Okay, this passed in Michigan with 63% of the vote. Obviously, this is what the people want, and you, as our federal representative, are you going to take this to the federal level on behalf of us? And we get some really standard pat obviously form letters regarding how horrible heroin is, which is rather confusing.
Or methamphetamine, you know, they'll compare it to that. You know, they just don't want to touch the subject. They just, because of their lobbying money. That's what it comes down to.
Well, the whole letter, in fact, we have one from our senator that the whole entire letter, the letter that was sent to him addressed medical marijuana, and never once does he, other than saying he's against it, then he goes on for 3-4 paragraphs about the dangers of heroin, which totally ignored the topic. I have another question here for you from Sam in Illinois. How do you feel doctors react to patients that ask for medical marijuana? Do you think that they're thinking that they're just trying to get past people, druggies, looking for their dope legally?
Oh, I definitely believe that in most cases that's true, because, again, the doctors are not taught this in medical school at all. And so they're just as brainwashed as most people. All they know about is what the government says, how bad it is for you. Therefore, the doctor's first thing is to do no harm. And so immediately they're going to be on the, you know, they're going to be abrasive and, you know, and not believe you. So what I tell patients to do is I don't tell patients to come out and tell their doctors that they're using medical cannabis. What I tell them to do is that once they have a problem, a physical problem, and hopefully their doctor is using a different regimen of different, you know, medicines for them, and probably just getting, you know, minimal results or marginal results, then when that person does discover that cannabis is the main thing that's helping, whether it's as an adjunct medicine helping the medicines that they take, or if they're able to even almost stop taking all those other medicines by just using medical cannabis, that's when that person needs to go to the doctor and say, "Doc, I need to talk to you." And you need to let them know what you're doing. And you need to let them know about patients at a time. And it'd be good if you had my book in hand to say, "Hey, look, here's a person that's been getting medicine from the government for 28 years. 28 years he's been getting this medicine from the government for his medical condition. Here's a book you can read." But if you don't also want to read that, go to Patients at a Time's website. Okay? They do a conference every 2 years that gives doctors knowledge to learn about medical cannabis. The AMA sanctions them to learn. Okay? The ANA sanctions nurses to learn. "Doc, I understand you don't know anything about the subject." You don't. Okay? This is where you learn. This is how you find out. So I always tell patients that that's how you start educating your doctor. You start getting them studies. You start trying to teach them. And eventually they'll come around. I also suggest if you're in a state that's not legal. And then once you do find a doctor, what you would do is then get a letter from that doctor saying that, and again, that letter is not out for public use, only if Johnny Law tries to make you a criminal. It would say that, you know, if he were legally allowed to recommend medical cannabis for his epilepsy, let's just say, that he would, and sign and date it, and with a phone number. Then you go to your clergy and get the same type of, and educate your clergy and get the same type of letter saying, "You know, I'm so glad that so-and-so is a great parishioner in our church, synagogue, whatever, and I'm so glad he gets relief from medical cannabis for his epilepsy." Again, signed by the minister, and dated, and with a phone number. And then go to attorney with those two letters and have a letter from the attorney saying that, you know, this is a patient with this disorder. That, again, this is all to Johnny Law. And that, you know, if for some reason you are thinking of making this person into a criminal, which you have a right to do, understand that I will be defending this person on a medical, you know, reasons for why they're using it. And there's a letter from the doctor. Why don't you call the doctor first? There's a letter from the minister. Why don't you call the minister first? Then if you still decide that you want to make this patient a criminal, then understand that that patient will be calling me. And when we go into a court of law, there's going to be the doctor there. There's going to be the clergy there. And are you really sure that you want to make this patient a criminal? So,
now, I saw your testimony in my state before we legalized, in fact,
yes.
Making just that point. I'm not sure who you were testifying to. Go ahead and tell the
It was a health committee, I believe.
And that was the video I saw, you used an elderly lady, but you said the first time you ever used that argument, you had a gentleman in another state that was obviously debilitated, and you were concerned that he was a criminal for smoking marijuana.
Right. Daryl Paulson was his name. He's in Minnesota. He's got cerebral palsy. And he's in an electric wheelchair. His feet go the other way. His hands aren't right. And if you look at him, he's very frail and everything else. And if you look at him, you cringe. Okay? And he's been using medical cannabis forever. And he's very vocal in the state, and everybody knows he uses it. He was best friends with Jesse Ventura when he was governor. So, yeah, the woman I've pointed out in Michigan, who was probably in her, I would say, mid-70s, maybe upper 70s, and she used medical cannabis. And the point was, what I was trying to make is, under your state law back then, she was a criminal. She was breaking your Michigan law. And so I turned to the one person, the one woman who was one of the main oppositions. I looked at her. I said, you know, per your law, she is a criminal. You need to get that state trooper, and you need to have her arrested. You know, and I looked at her. I said, you know, I don't know about you, but I sure would sleep better at night knowing she's behind bars. Wouldn't you? So here was a woman that could barely move out of a wheelchair, who uses medical cannabis for probably arthritis. It could have been cancer. I'm not really sure what she was using it for. I don't really remember. But the point is, she was a user. She was a patient. And just because she was elderly and everything else, she was no criminal. She shouldn't have been put in jail, but that law says that she should have. So the law needs to be changed.
And now, earlier we were talking about the DEA and the fact that they pose as the experts. And I know from talking to George that the DEA, there was a DEA administrative judge that found just the opposite, but was ignored.
Right. It was hearings. A lawsuit that we tried to get reclassification of cannabis been going on since the early 70s. In reality, it's still going on. But they were able to hold hearings. The courts ordered DEA to hold 2 years worth of hearings. So everybody that was in favor of medical cannabis testified in favor. Everybody that was against it testified against it. And then he took 1 year to make his decision. And his decision was, he stated it was one of the most benign substances known to mankind and that it should be reclassified and used as a medicine. And DEA said, sorry, we're not going to go along with that. You know, the law review judge, administrative law review judge, the way they do that, DEA does not have to listen to the law review judge. Just like recently with University of Massachusetts wanting to start another growth center besides Mississippi. And they went to court, and they went to a law review judge. They had hearings, and the law review judge ruled in favor that they should be allowed to start them with a growth facility. And then DEA says, you know, I don't like that answer. We're not going to let them do it. So it must be nice to have to go to court, be ordered to go to court, and then they have the trial or whatever. The decision comes down, and you say, nah, I don't like that decision. I'm not going to go along with it. Wouldn't it be nice if the average individual could do that? But no, we can't do that, but DEA can.
Yeah, it would be nice when they haul us into court for smoking marijuana. If the judge finds us guilty, we could say, oh, I don't like that decision. We'll just forget that.
Exactly.
I don't think they don't allow it in that direction. Now, is there anything else? We're running short on time here. We've got a few minutes. Is there anything that you really wanted to say to the listeners that you feel that we haven't covered that's important to you? You've been in this fight for a long time, so I want you to say what you need to say.
Well, what's important is this, and that there we've got 14 states, District of Columbia, but we have all these other states that have not legalized medical use yet. And that's what my book is for. That's what Patients Out of Time is for. You need to utilize our expertise. We can help you learn to go about helping yourself, because you've got to do it yourself. You've got to put the committee together. You've got to put the people on the state together to be able to implement a law. But what you have to do is you have to learn, first of all, the history. Learn that, you know, you need to know that medical cannabis was legal in this country from 1860 to 1937. You need to know why it became illegal. You need to know all that before you're going to convince anyone else. And then once you have learned that, then with our help, by contacting us, we will be able to help you figure out monetarily what you need to do, and mostly politically what you need to do. In each state, it can be done. And that's what it's going to take, because until we can get it reclassified under the federal government, under federal law, it's going to take more states. And once we go past that 25 states, we get to 26, then Congress is going to have to do something. So at that point, you know, I'm hoping that'll happen, that the laws will change nationwide. So, you know, we'll all be in the same situation where we don't have to worry about being arrested. So I think it's important they you know, go to my website, mymedicinethebook.com, because it's a great lobbying tool. And again, the other aspect that I didn't touch on that's in the book is parents with devastating children with devastating diseases. And the aspect there is my disease at age 10, I had to be told everything about the disorder, and I had to make all the decisions, not the doctors, not my parents. And too many times what I see in this country is if you have a 5-year-old, 6-year-old that has cancer, that's devastating. It's sad. But the doctor decides what treatment to do. The parents decide, okay, and then they do it. They don't take the child into consideration. What they need to do is incorporate that child into the medical treatment and say, this is what's wrong with you. This is what the doctor wants to do. This is what we're thinking about. How do you feel about this? What do you feel about? And you involve the child in their treatment. I think it's very important. I don't care how old they are. They need to be involved. And then, God forbid, that child has cancer, and they have surgery, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, and that child dies. Okay, it's devastating for the parents, but not for the child. The child knows no better. Okay? Now, granted, it's devastating for the child, devastating for the doctor. That's when you say to the doctor, doctor, look, all you are is an MD. You're not a GOD. You do the best you can. That's all we want. That's all any patient's asking for is give us the best medicine possible. Okay, that's all we want. We don't ask this devastating disorder. Okay, but we have it. You deal with it. You do the best you can. You just want the best medicine. That's all I ever wanted. Well, I was lucky enough to be able to get the best medicine for me. And today, 28 years later, I take no narcotics. I take no drugs. I take no nothing. Productive member of society. And so, yes, I'm doing fine, but I can't sit back. I've got to help others to get the same respect in the same way that I am. So that's what we want to see happen, is just patients not be prosecuted for being sick. That simple.
Well, we all, those of us who have benefited from your fight and from George's fight over the past 2-3 decades now, you have our deepest appreciation. We are out of time here. I thank you so much for being here, and George did hear most of it. His sound kept cutting out.
Okay.
So, again, good luck with your book, and good luck in the fight. As more states legalize, you have more patients who are able to stand up and go, you know, I use this, and I'm just fine. And that hopefully we will reach that tipping point while you guys are still around to enjoy it. Meanwhile, like I said, we enjoy the fact that you guys are a thorn in the side of the feds. So, thank you so much.
My pleasure, and y'all keep up the good work, and I'll be glad to do it again anytime you want to.
Okay, well, thank you. I wish you success in with your book and your continuing fight. Now, for my audience, please join Bessima Farhat on her return next week to The People Speak, when her guest will be Dr. Stephen Greer, the founder and director of the Disclosure Project. That's next week on The People Speak Show on BBS Radio, 8:55 to 9:55 Eastern Standard Time. Thank you all, and you have a good night.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land.